They have confessed that it is impossible to reach and observe the subtler phenomena of nature without interfering with these same phenomena in the very process of observation. The moment scientific research entered the mysterious subatomic world of electrons, neutrons and protons, it had to recognize that the observer himself played a role in determining the phenomena observed by him. What is immediately seen as the outside thing is really the mental picture. Science has slowly begun to realize this. The older scientific theories of optical illusion, for instance, made it purely physical, attributing it to some physiological disturbance of the retina or to a defect in the muscles of the eye, whereas the later ones introduce a definite mental ingredient. Matter is no longer all that matters. The older theories thought illusion an unimportant abnormality, whereas the later ones find it is bound up with the process of perception from beginning to end. To mistake the bodily structure for the immaterial consciousness itself and to fall into the old trap of regarding the brain of flesh as the mystery of mind, are natural and pardonable errors in the secret of space and time. Unreflective and uninstructed persons, in those philosophically unsophisticated people who turn in disgust from the first mention of this mentalistic doctrine, that a thing which is touched, seen and tasted is as intern alio the mind, as it is external to the body, and that the body is in its own turn just as internal to the mind, irritates their common sense. Only the deepest reflection can show that the sensations derived from the human body itself are really as objective as sensations derived from fountain pens, because they are capable of being observed by mind, the subject. Thus second thought refutes what first impression asserts. However, it would be quite a mistake to suppose that this teaching asks us to believe that visible objects are not seen outside our own body, that because it describes these objects as mental perceptions they must therefore be placed somewhere inside our body, and that the glazed window before which we are seated is no nearer than yonder twinkling star. To attempt to place a house within the bony skull of a man is the futile endeavor of those who have failed to understand this doctrine, which, it need hardly be said, is entirely exempt from any expression of such absurdity. No material object of such a size could possibly exist within the material head of man. Such impossible and improbable beliefs belong to the annals of lunacy and not to the annals of the hidden philosophy of India. The latter does emphatically agree that we see objects like houses and trees outside our bodies and certainly not inside them, and that all such objects are most undoubtedly seen to be at a distance from us as well as from each other. What it does assert is that the perceptions of the objects being purely mental, and it being impossible to assign any special spatial location to the mind, it is consequently impossible to say that these objects are seen at a distance from the mind itself. The notion of the body's existence as separate from mind, from awareness, is the fashionable fallacy entertained by the materialistic. To invest the body with the qualities which should be ascribed to the mind is strangely to misinterpret all experience. We have no right to treat our knowledge of all external objects as mental but that of our own body as material. Such a distinction is illogical and unjustifiable. If it be true to say that everything is known through the mind, it will be true not only of all external objects but also of our own body, with its head, hands, trunk, legs and feet. These also are necessarily known mentally. There are no grounds whatever for thinking that they come in a different class from that of external objects. We must, therefore, treat the body in exactly the same way in which we treat all other objects and regard our awareness of it solely as the awareness of thought. Nor must we make the mistake of many novices in this study, and most critics who disdain it, of imagining that the human body is known through the body alone, although the objects which are outside it are all mentally known. Our body with its five sense instruments, the eye, ear, nose, tongue and skin, exists in precisely the same manner as a brick wall, so far as it exists as an idea of consciousness. We are aware of the sense instruments themselves because of the sensations derived from them and not otherwise, for the reason that it consists of a certain shape, size, color, etc., which are made known to us by the mind. The entire body, even the physical brain, is as much within the mind and we are as much dependent upon the mind for awareness of its existence as we are for awareness of a brick wall. The fact is that most men confuse their skin with their mind. They do not comprehend that the distance that extends from the surface of their body to the nearest thing is emphatically not the distance that extends from the latter to their mind. The cardinal error is to mistake extra-bodily existence for extra-mental existence. Mind unconsciously projects its perceptions into space and then views the things of its own making. Let us sum up these statements by applying a little analytic treatment, a little corrosive criticism to this word external. Nobody has ever seen an object outside the mind, but only outside the body. Putting aside the practical standpoint and speaking philosophically, it is wrong to talk of external objects, for even the body is known ultimately as a thought and is therefore mental, thus nothing at all is ever really external. To talk of an object being even outside the body is to talk of it being outside a thought, that is outside a mental thing, that is outside the mind, which is impossible. Those who use the word external ought to define whether they mean external to body or to mind. For if to body, then it has been shown that the body itself is internal to mind, so the objects themselves must also be internal to mind. And if to the mind, then the notion of inside and outside is wholly inapplicable. Hence we may not accurately say anything is external, we may only say it exists. The word contains its own contradiction. It belongs to an irrational and superstitious jargon. From the first beginnings of consciousness, each object is incessantly presented to the mind as being something apart and independent. We not only recognize a thing, but we recognize it as the secret of space and time having a particular shape and size and standing at a certain distance away from our own body and from other things. We recognize it to exist in space. We are seeing it spatially. We possess an inveterate conviction, for example, that the wall which we see is situated out there in space, and we feel that we dare not desert this conviction without losing our sanity. But we must begin to face a queer problem. If no sensation can extrude itself beyond the periphery of the body, because every sensation is supposed to be the internal result of the operation of a bodily sense instrument, why do we perceive the finished thought as a form extended in space? All objects said to be external stand in spatial relation to each other, but how can our ideas of them, which are apparently all that we know, be considered as having positions in space? If it has been shown that our thoughts or observations of these objects really are our experiences of them, why is it that this self-same experience confutes our reasoning, for it reveals the objects as standing entirely separate from and outside bodies? How can an image which is said to be internal appear to us as an object which is external and which possesses spatial characteristics? How can colors which are scientifically provable as being optical interpretations, that is within the eyes, be able to assume the forms of independent outside things? The puzzle in short is how to account for the conversion of a purely mental experience into a seemingly separate and independent one, and for the projection of a purely internal experience into an external one. To cast some light upon the answers to these questions, we must make a lengthy scientific examination of certain aspects of the process of perceiving things through the senses. There exists a certain anomalous functioning of the senses which seems of trivial importance when considered from a practical point of view, but which actually offers unique material for an approach to profounder understanding of the places taken by the senses and the mind in observation of the world. Those peculiar errors of the senses which we call illusion and those mysterious derangements of the mind which we call hallucination provide interesting illustration of a principle whose weighty importance is usually overlooked by the unscientific or non-philosophical mind. To underrate their instructive value because of their practical pettiness would be a mistake. The experience of illusion shares certain common elements with constant and habitual experience, although it appears to mock sardonically at it. The psychological act of perception is present in both, although the causes differ. The process whereby we become conscious of an illusion cannot be different from the way in which we become conscious of any ordinary thing. As an act of awareness, both are indeed the same, even though one is said to be erroneous and the other accurate. Science has found that the study of what is abnormal sheds new light on what is normal. Disturbances in the psychic process and defects in the physiological mechanism sometimes reveal valuable clues to the working of both or confirm the results previously obtained by scientific examination and pure reflection. Therefore, when the mechanism of sensation is disturbed, as in illusions, and the physical stimulus is misconstrued, we get a glimpse of how the mechanism itself operates. Careful and systematic dissection of these abnormal experiences supplies valuable pointers which will help to render the intricate processes of perception more intelligible and light up more revealingly the respective roles played by the observing mind, the observing senses and the observed object. Therefore, it is because of its scientific worth in helping to explain sense experience that the subject of illusion is here taken up. The Greek intellectuals like Aristotle were troubled about the easy way men could be deceived by their senses, but the Indian sages like Gaudapada not only noted this fact but carried their investigation to the last possible stage. For they were troubled about the easy way men could be deceived by their mind. The full implications of the phenomena of illusions, which every philosophy worth the name is called upon to investigate, require for their grasp a refined subtlety of apprehension which is not often found among Occidentals. The achievements of the Aryan races in mental and physical spheres entitle them to superior status, but it is the Indo-Aryan branch which has proportionately produced the most men whose sharpness of concentration and subtlety of thought have combined with a singular subdual of the desires and egoisms which might weaken their undivided aim to pursue philosophy. Every aspect of illusion and hallucination has been thoroughly dealt with by the Indian sages, for they had a scientific bent of mind and would accept nothing until it had been investigated and verified. Unfortunately, the sages disappeared, their knowledge was largely lost and Indian philosophy degenerated with the lapse of centuries into the empty babbling speculation which it became in other countries. Illusions are connected with a strange factor in perception which ought long ago to have set inquiring Western minds on the correct. This term is used only in its genuinely scientific sense, the secret of space and time tracked to psychological truth, for it was noticed and deeply pondered on by Indian sages thousands of years ago, but its significance has not received proper attention in the West. And this is that we observe only what we are paying attention to. That amid all the multitude of retinal experiences we unconsciously select those only in which we are interested. Thus we may be reading a book whilst seated in a room, or we may be in an office at work which is deeply fascinating or of high importance. A clock may twice strike the hour and yet we may not remember hearing its chimes simply because attention has been highly concentrated on the reading or the work. The impressions are actually made on the sense instrument, the sound waves succeed in striking the tympanums of healthy ears, but owing to the dissociation of attention they are not perceived by us although they are heard by other persons. We may be walking in the street and a passing friend may greet us. Yet if we are plunged in deep reflection we fail to see him and do not return his greeting. We see what we are looking for rather than what we are looking at. Consciousness grades down to dimness or even nothingness where we pay no attention to what we see whilst it compensatingly vividly lights up the object towards which thought has been surrendered in utter concentration. When any piece of work is being attended to so completely as to occupy consciousness to the exclusion of all else, events may occur or objects may be present to the gaze and yet escape attention and pass unnoted. They remain outside the field of awareness although inside the field of sense impression. That which dominates the mind dictates that which shall be perceived. This is one lesson to be learned. When attention of the sensory faculties is preoccupied by the ideas of internal reverie the path to their external activity is blocked. This is practically illustrated by the case of yogis who are totally plunged in the state of trance or coma and then remain unaware or pain-free when cut with knives or buried beneath the ground. The mental factor of attention plays a powerful role in determining the content of what we perceive. The more the mind is directed to a bodily hurt, the more intense and intolerable does the pain become. On the other hand, the more the mind is occupied with some other event, the less troublesome will the hurt be felt. When thought flags or is totally withdrawn, we may be blind to what is actually present before our eyes. This extraordinary fact should alone have been a plain hint that the functioning of the mind both contributes to and withdraws something from the making of the world we witness. It should have been a warning that the mental factor cannot rightly be left out of any account of sense experience. For if the mind does not cooperate with the senses, there will be no conscious experience of any external object, however much the physical conditions may be fulfilled. Or if it cooperates imperfectly, then experience will become less clear and less intense in proportion. It is difficult to become aware of the degree of mental interference when our normal state gives no evidence of it. We can hope, however, to do so by watching for abnormal experiences and unusual events which cause rifts in the veil of perception, as it were. It has already been pointed out that psychologically it is an error to separate illusions from the accepted facts of normal life. It is from the analytic study of such exceptional deviations from the ordinary course of nature that we gain fresh knowledge of what such course really is. If an illusion is a false sensory impression, it is still an impression no matter how it arises. Let us consider first the class of illusions which belong to nature. The most elementary consideration of this question brings a startling revelation. Take, for example, the simple chair upon which you are sitting. Here is a solid, hard and tangible object made of a natural material substance, which you call wood. That is the truth about this chair so far as you are concerned. Go, however, to the laboratory of a scientist. Let him take a piece of this wood of which your chair is constructed and submit it to his searching analytic examination. He will successively reduce it to molecules, atoms, electrons, protons and neutrons. He will tell you finally that the wood consists of nothing more solid than a series of electrical radiations or, in plain language, of electricity. Yet despite such expert instructions and scornful of what irrefutable reason tells you, your five senses will continue to report wood as being something most substantial, the very opposite of whatever you can imagine electrical energy to be. Does this not mean that you are experiencing an amazing illusion, one that is stranger than any conjurer's feat? Indeed, the entire planet itself offers us a curious example of great masses of solid, liquid and gaseous substances which are not really what they seem. For, if scientific investigation has not deceived itself, they are whirling winds of electrical energy, that is, the lofty mountains, flowing rivers, rolling seas and green fields are not really constituted as we see them. Their existence is certainly undeniable, but their appearance as lumps of matter is fundamentally illusory. The study of modern scientific geography reveals the extraordinary fact that millions of persons are really walking upon this globe with their heads suspended downwards and with their feet the secret of space and time clinging to rather than resting on the earth. Such a statement, taken as it stands upon the printed sheet, is so astonishing that so-called common sense, when it is common uninstructed opinion, refuses to believe it. Although the acceptance of the proved fact of the globular shape of our planet leaves us with no other alternative but to accept this further finding, which is so contradictory to what our eyes tell us. What man would have known this fact if the scientists, through constant probing, had not ascertained it for him and thus discovered that the popular belief about the human bodily relation to the surface of the earth is purely illusory? This simple illustration may help us to grasp why those who insist on accepting the testimony of their immediate sense impressions as alone being true are unfit for philosophy. When the full moon rises, glowing redly, near the horizon, it assumes the size of an enormous wagon wheel. But see the same moon when it is overhead and it has shrunk to the relative size of a coin. Which appearance are you to take as the correct one? Your eyes are not to be blamed, for the retina records a perfectly accurate image in both cases. The difference occurs because you unconsciously measure the suddenly rising moon on the same scale by which you habitually measure the hills, trees, buildings or other objects which also occupy the horizon, whereas you ordinarily use quite another scale to measure those which are far overhead. Thus the sun setting behind a familiar full-branched tree will appear tremendously magnified because it fills the space occupied by the branches. You set up a false standard of perception through established habit and then judge the sun's or moon's size by it. But where does this error really occur? It is not in the object nor in your eyes. It can only occur in your mind, for it is a mistake of interpretation, that is a mental activity. The apparent enlargement of sun or moon is actually present in your idea. Look at the landscape spread out before you in the morning. Your eyes may see nothing more in the background than a dull mist which fills the horizon. Photograph the mist with the help of a special plate sensitive to infrared rays. The camera will then grasp what the unaided sight cannot, for it will faithfully register the image of a hitherto unseen range of mountains 20 miles away. Similarly, a sensitive spectroscope and photographic plate will reveal the existence of stars in apparently empty space even where a powerful telescope fails to reveal them. The fact that such natural illusions do exist and are possible is itself a critique of our knowledge of the world and its validity. If the senses can deceive us in these cases, is it not likely that they can deceive us in others which pass unnoticed? These instances should give us ground not so much for distrusting the senses, for they are not directly to blame for these errors, as for distrusting our interpretations of the reports of the senses. Yes, the senses can delude us. An observer in a rapidly descending aeroplane actually sees the earth rushing upwards, and a traveler in an express train actually sees telegraph poles moving past him. These are visual errors, but they help to illustrate how the process of vision really works. For they betray an element of judgment, that is of mental contribution, in what appears as the finished deliverance of the senses. Why do the last 100 yards of a 4-mile walk seem much longer than the first 100 yards when the impressions made on the senses of sight and touch are still the same as before, still as accurate? The answer is that the tired muscles have suggested a different series of exaggerated sensations, which produce the illusions of magnified movement and lengthened duration. The sensations, we must remember, are mental. Enter a room which has been somewhat darkened and let the light of a small window fall on a green-colored coat. Look at it through a piece of red glass. You may be startled to discover that it appears black. Then look at a red garment through blue glass and it also will seem to be black. Fit a green electric bulb and look at a blue coat with your naked eye. It too will appear black. Or fit a red bulb and gaze at a bunch of yellow primroses. The flowers will look strange, for they will look red. And it is a common experience to find that certain shades of cloth which look green in daylight change their color to brown in artificial light. And santonin, a poisonous drug, if taken in a certain degree, causes many things to appear yellow. The plain implication of such optical illusions is that you must be prepared at least to mistrust not your senses but their working. For they are unable to work without the mind. When you gaze at a patch of green-colored cloth for some time and then turn to look at a different patch of gray-colored cloth, the latter will assume a rose-red tint. The sense impressions of gray color cannot have changed. What is wrong is that the mind has misinterpreted them because present sensations are relative to previous ones and affected by them because in forming the images of experience the mind works on what it receives. You see a magnificent rainbow arched from earth to heaven. The secret of space and time, but the pilot of an aeroplane passing through it will see nothing at all. A clear instance of relativity. The lovely colors which touch the sky at dawn and sunset are partly the consequence of drifting dust and hanging vapor scattered in the air. Yet you see neither dust nor vapor and superimpose the colorings upon the space they fill. When water drops are large enough to break light up into the spectrum, we perceive a beautiful rainbow. When they are assembled as massed clouds, they are radiantly white when they reflect the sun's rays to your eyes, but are dismally gray or black when they are so placed as to be unable to do so. Amid all these alternations of colorful dress and bleak veiling, the light certainly does not change its own nature, it remains one and the same, but only appears to be different to different observers at different times. Thus the vast canopy of heaven is frequently a gigantic illusion of color, teaching the unheeding minds of men to be wary of what they see, to reflect upon the relativity of all things and to grasp the grand difference between seeming and being. Look into a tumbler of clean water. Your eyes tell you that it is absolutely pure. Examine the same water under a microscope and you will find it to be swarming with countless animalculae. Lettuce may be thoroughly washed and appear temptingly clean, but here again the microscope finds it to be full of bacteria. In both cases, the unaided senses not only fail to tell you the truth, but actually mislead you into illusion. When a stick is partly immersed in a glass bowl filled with water, it will appear to be bent out of position at the place where it touched the surface of the water, so that the lower part will seem to be lifted upward out of its straight course. Here the visual experience gives definitely inaccurate information about the shape of the stick, and will persist in doing so however perfect your eyes and however often the stick is seen. Here is a wooden telegraph pole. When we apply a measuring rod, we find it to be 40 feet high. If we walk some distance away from it and view it, it appears somewhat smaller. And if we proceed considerably farther in the same direction and again look at it, the height has been brought down to a mere few feet. Is the pole this little stick which is now visible? Is it the object which was so clearly and so convincingly 40 feet long when measured? Here are three different heights which the pole appears to possess. Which one represents the real as apart from the apparent height? If we reply that the measured figure is alone correct, then we must explain why a measuring rod should be more privileged than a man, and why the mathematical concept, that is idea, 40 feet should be entitled to take precedence of the other idea, 4 feet, which arises when standing a considerable distance away. Nor is this all, for we shall also have to explain why the measuring rod, which is merely a length of wood, should be assigned certitude of length when there is such uncertainty about the telegraph pole, which is also a length of wood. For it is evident that whether we are standing immediately close to the pole or to the rod, or whether we are standing at 100 yards distance from them, what we see in both cases is only the object as it appears to us. This point has been covered in our scientific analysis of relativity in an earlier chapter. It raises serious and startling questions. Is the pole one thing and what we see of it another? Do we see things as they really are, or only as they appear to us? If the latter, are we doomed to perceive appearances only, never their reality? The answers to these questions now begin to reveal themselves from our study of the perceptive process. For we have begun to learn that what we really see are the images formed by our own mind. Whether formed subconsciously or consciously, they are still nothing more than mental images, thoughts. All appearances of poles or rods are but the revelations of our mind. We see our thoughts of things, not the things themselves. The question of what is the reality behind these appearances, what is the real object that gives rise to the thoughts about it, is too advanced to be dealt with here and will be taken up later. What is true of sight may also be true of other senses. There are illusions of touch, for instance. Take 3 bowls of water, respectively cold, tepid, and as hot as is bearable. Put your left hand in the hot water and at the same time plunge your right hand in the cold water. Keep both hands immersed for 2 or 3 minutes. Then withdraw them quickly, shake off the drops and plunge both hands in the bowl containing lukewarm water. The water will feel cold to your left hand but warm to the right one. The sense of touch in each limb will contradict the other, for it will estimate different temperatures for the same water. That the same water is both hot and cold is not only a clear discrepancy between sense reports but also an astonishing illustration how present sensations do depend on previous ones, and that what we actually feel is partly a projection by memory from past experience. Let a spade remain outdoors throughout a frosty night. Pick it up next morning. The wooden handle will feel a little cold, but the secret of space and time metal part will feel intensely chill. Touch will therefore yield a striking difference in the temperature of both parts of the same spade. Test them with a thermometer, however, and they will be found to register an equal degree of cold. So much for the dangers of trusting the accuracy of what we actually experience. The illusions of geometry. Let us next consider a totally different class of illusions, those which man has artificially created. There are interesting instances of geometric illusions which are known to students of physics, physiology and psychology. figure shows four horizontal lines of apparently unequal length, each bounded by short oblique lines that turn inward or outward. Which line do you estimate as the longest? Measure them with a marked ruler and they will all be found quite equal. The top line looks the shortest because the eye locates its end somewhere in the arrowhead and does not follow it to the tip